Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, February 27th, 2018.
At Cleveland Elementary today, school began on time, but not as usual.
Back in 1989, long before Parkland or Sandy Hook or even Columbine, there was Cleveland Elementary School in Stockton, California.
26-year-old Patrick Edward Purdy attended Cleveland Elementary School from kindergarten to third grade. But there is still no answer to the biggest question of all. Why Purdy walked onto the playground at lunchtime and mowed down 35 children and a teacher with automatic weapons before killing himself.
That's a newscast from 1989 when a gunman killed five school children and wounded 32 before killing himself. It happened nearly 30 years ago, but that script, when you hear it today, sounds familiar. And people then could have had no idea how many times their nightmare would be played again and again.
The nation was watching as students and teachers struggled to make sense out of what happened here.
I don't know that there's any precedent for this anywhere in public school history.
Even then, three decades ago, it was high school students trying to hold the NRA accountable.
Mr. Blackman, you said that the average American citizen is usually the one that's hurt by gun laws. Now, what he shot these people with was an AK-47, which is a military assault rifle made by Russians to kill people, not for hunting, not to protect yourself at home, but to kill. And I want to know why the NRA feels that these weapons should be on the streets. People should be using these weapons, which are also used in drive-by shootings in LA, which kill a number of people every day and every year throughout the state of California.
First of all, drive-by shootings can involve any type of firearm. That's the thing. If you let violent criminals on the streets, you're going to have violent acts.
That exchange sounds a lot like what we're hearing today after the Parkland shooting in Florida. But there was one major difference back in 1989. The massacre at Cleveland Elementary School in Stockton, California, spurred Congress to action.
And it just really caught my attention, and I got my staff to start looking into it, what these weapons were. I was just overwhelmed by these in the old days, they called machine guns.
That's Senator Dennis DeConcini, a former Democratic U.S. Senator from Arizona, and his Senate colleagues took notice, too.
We're holding a hearing today on the question of what we do about assault weapons. We had a very dramatic illustration just recently in Stockton, California, where five innocent children who happen to be Asian Americans were killed by an assault weapon.
Today, a look behind the scenes at the political moment that gave rise to the 1994 assault weapons ban. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway. It's been nearly a quarter century since Congress last passed significant gun control legislation. In 1994, President Bill Clinton signed into law the Public Safety and Recreational Firearms Use Protection Act, most commonly remembered for one provision tucked inside the assault weapons ban. Patrick Griffin was assistant for legislative affairs to President Clinton at the time.
The president was speaking to a Democratic Senate conference out in Southern Maryland someplace, where Senator Feinstein was in the audience and asked the president, what's the status of this issue? And I thought it was a little odd, since the legislation was sitting in her committee, of which she was the chairwoman. And the president kind of turned to me in the meeting and said, where are we? And I simply said it was in the chairwoman's committee. After that meeting, we were going back in Marine One, flying back to D.C., and the president said, you know, why aren't we kind of driving this issue? And I said, well, I hadn't gotten direct instructions to do that, but I can see your face and the tone of your voice that this is a priority.
Patrick Griffin knew that it wouldn't be easy whipping support for an assault weapons ban in Congress, but he set out to devise a plan with the help of Leon Panetta, who at the time was President Clinton's chief of staff.
The plan for doing it was to have it attached to a crime bill, which the president was aggressively promoting, and it was a somewhat controversial bill in and of itself.
The crime bill was hugely important for Clinton. Democrats suffered a reputation for being soft on crime, and this bill could help change that. But there was a lot not to like about the crime bill for Democrats, like, for instance, 28 new death penalty provisions. Bill Clinton hoped that the assault weapons ban would lure those Democrats to support the bill without jeopardizing the support of too many Republicans who prioritize the Second Amendment, and also the support of the NRA and its enormous lobbying power. Dennis DeConcini, the senator from Arizona, had a good record with the NRA. At one point, he was even named the NRA's Legislator of the Month. And he remembers trying to convince the organization to get on board with an assault weapons ban.
When I wanted to try to get the NRA to support this, I had Mr. LaPierre, who's still there, and a guy named Jim Baker, who was their legislative assistant director at the time, and I had him up to the office, and I told him what I was going to do, and I might have given him a rough draft, I can't remember, but I told him I was going to outlaw nine automatic weapons and some other weapons that had automatic firing capabilities. And I said, you know, you guys should get behind this, and maybe we can compromise and work something out. And they were very, very adamant that there could be no compromise here. They were sorry. And I kept talking to them. And one of them, I can't remember which one, told me, well, you know, Senator, said, when we went along with the plastic gun restriction and passed that bill, our membership went down, meaning there was hardcore NRA members that felt they should not have given in even on that issue. And that's what they told me is one of the reasons, one, that they could not support my legislation.
Meanwhile, at the White House, Legislative Affairs Director Patrick Griffin was having his own trouble getting support for the bill, even among the Democratic leadership.
The leadership then asked to meet with the president in the Oval Office, and I remember it also vividly. It was Speaker Foley, Majority Leader Gephardt, and Whip Bonnier came into the Oval Office, and the president and the vice president, Gore, was there, and myself and Chief of Staff Panetta and maybe one or two other staffers. And basically they said that if you insist on including the assault weapon ban in this piece of legislation, we will not help you in any way pass this bill. What it resulted in was that Leon Panetta and I had to rely on our own, what we call the whip operation, seeing if we can get the votes one by one to pass this crime bill that would include the assault weapon ban. The Democratic leadership gave us a room to work in, but that was about it.
But Griffin and Panetta weren't quite alone. There were some loud voices in the Senate pushing this legislation, like longtime gun control advocate Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
Anybody who's reasonable in the House, at least as far as I can see, has got to vote for this legislation because these weapons are doing just terrible things in schoolyards, in banks, in workplaces, all across this nation. And I think it's creating a level of anxiety and fear that we can well do without.
When the day of the vote arrived in the House, Patrick Griffin watched nervously from the chamber.
So I was anxious. I really didn't want to be up in the House chamber.
The question is on the passage of the bill.
There was a major vote, which would have been to strike this provision out of the bill. And it prevailed by one vote.
So many is in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Opinion of the chair, the ayes have it.
So that meant it was in the bill and it was going to go to the Senate. You know, I was just torn. I mean, but I was up there and everybody's cheering and all I had was a knot in my stomach about it. They were not happy that this passed.
Patrick Griffin, again, from Bill Clinton's White House, recalling a night not long after the House vote in a meeting at the offices of Democratic Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, along with Tom Foley, the Democratic Speaker of the House.
Speaker Foley had this big kind of down dog face on, and he says this is going to be problematic. And then this big bolt of lightning and thunder struck. We all kind of shook, but took it as a very ominous sign.
Democrats were still on edge about their reelections, even taking signs from the storm outside the Capitol. The Senate eventually passed a different version of the bill than the one the House had agreed to. And during negotiations, desperate to pass that assault weapons ban, a 10-year sunset clause was added. In other words, an expiration date. The ban would end after 10 years unless Congress reinstated it.
It might have felt like a concession to the anti-assault weapon folks, but believe me, it gave them very little to no comfort. That vote was going to have immediate impact, and did, on their careers. And the fact that there was a sunset provision was really meaningless in the context of what those folks were facing in that election in the following November.
The 10-year limit did its job, and on September 13th, 1994, President Bill Clinton signed the Public Safety and Recreational Firearms Use Protection Act.
Today, the will of the American people has triumphed over a generation of division and paralysis. We've won a chance to work together. So in that spirit, let us rededicate ourselves today to making this law become the life of our country.
So what exactly did the assault weapons ban accomplish? For 10 years, from 1994 to 2004, it promised to ban semi-automatic assault weapons manufactured after the bill's passing. But any assault rifle that you owned prior to the bill passing was okay and still legal. It could even be resold. The law also banned large, high-capacity magazines holding more than 10 rounds. A Democratic victory, but a limited and short-lived one.
CNN is reporting tonight that, quote, very likely, the Republicans will take control of the United States House of Representatives with up to 50 seats.
Turns out Patrick Griffin and Democrats were right to worry. Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution had arrived.
We lost 54, 55 House seats in that election in 94 that turned, and many, if not most, were from rural South and Midwest states or districts that were anti-gun control. And in most cases, if not all cases, the reason that was given for their loss was the assault weapon ban.
So after that loss, was the assault weapons ban worth it? And beyond just the politics, did it actually work? The assault weapons ban was law for 10 years, 1994 to 2004. Did it save lives? Did it help prevent violent crime and mass shootings? Professor Daniel Webster is the director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
Professor, you've written that we need to be realistic about the ability of an assault weapons ban to curb violence. What did you mean?
We have a very high rate of gun violence in the United States. The vast majority of that violence, however, does not look like the mass shootings that, you know, we spend a lot of time, for understandable reasons, concerning ourselves with. When you think about the safety of our children going to schools, those events stick in our mind. And quite commonly, not always, of course, but commonly, the high casualty count mass shootings, assault weapons are typically involved. But most violence, of course, in the United States is committed with handguns.
Well, let's talk about the assault weapons ban between 94 and 2004. What do we know about those years in terms of what happened to violent crime in general, mass shooting specifically, and the types of crimes that assault weapons are part of?
Sure. So criminologist Christopher Cooper, now at George Mason University, led a very extensive study looking at the assault weapon ban and its effects. He found that there, first of all, just before the ban, there was a huge spike in sales for such guns. And he also found that there were leakage points, if you will, a lot of copycat models that were introduced. What he found, however, in looking at overall crime rates and violence committed with firearms, particularly homicides, he found no measurable effect of the assault weapon ban. Most importantly, I think, again, when we think about assault weapons, we think about mass shootings. Dr. Coper did not examine the effect of the ban on mass shootings, or if you think specifically, how might an assault weapon facilitate casualties? Really, it has to do with how many people are shot. So that outcome was not studied in Dr. Coper's research. If you look at the data of what's happened after the ban has expired, assault weapons have become far more common as far as what people own. And most dramatically, we see the average number of victims shot in mass shootings has gone up quite significantly post-ban.
So, Dr. Webster, America is talking about an assault weapons ban once again. It's easy to see why. Americans are watching AR-15s and similar weapons being used repeatedly in these high-profile crimes. What do Americans need to know about how effective a new ban might be, or how that ban might have to be designed to help prevent the kinds of shootings that we're seeing on our televisions?
Well, probably the most important thing is ammunition capacity. So the large capacity magazine ban is really particularly key here. I think the other important takeaway is that you want to design your ban in a manner that it's not easy to make copycat models with very modest differences in the weapons. I think another thing that could be considered, but I understand politically is probably not feasible, is what we did with machine guns or fully automatic guns, where there is full registry of such weapons. So, I mean, if I'm designing the most effective type of restriction, I would probably include that. But I don't expect that will happen simply because of political constraints.
Yeah, you mentioned those political constraints in this country, and they're significant. And look, when we look at the reality of a new ban in this country, Dr. Webster, even if one were to come into effect, lots of people, including Senator Marco Rubio just weeks ago, have pointed out that there are 300 million guns already in this country. He said he would be willing to entertain a ban if he thought that one could be effective, but with so many guns already on the market, an assault weapons ban might make people feel like they've done something without having much of a discernible effect on safety.
Well, you certainly have to concern yourself with the guns that are already available right now. Again, I think that, look, there are a lot of weapons available. The question really is, are those weapons easily available to someone who wants to get them? I think anytime you single out one particular gun policy, you can find another vulnerability in another place. So having a comprehensive background check system with some teeth in it, I think would also make a difference, so that if someone who privately owned assault weapons couldn't just set up shop and sell them, put up ads on internets or go to gun shows and sell them with no background checks or record-keeping process. So I think it's difficult to think of some of these things in isolation, because really the policies, if the intent, of course, is to maximize public safety while minimizing any restrictions on rights, you want to have a comprehensive system that, of course, would have appropriate background checks involved.
Well, Professor Daniel Webster, you're a public health expert, not a political analyst, but here's a key question. Do you see any signs that the body politic is moving any closer to policies that would benefit safety and benefit the public health in the way that you're describing?
Well, all the polls clearly indicate that the public is very ready for such change. The more difficult question is, will their elected officials listen to them, or will they listen to special interest lobby groups? We are at a change point, and really time will tell in these upcoming elections what change ultimately emerges from it.
Professor Daniel Webster, director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
It's been 4 years since the militant Islamist group Boko Haram kidnapped 276 girls from a high school in Chibok, Nigeria. The attack caused international outrage, but more than 100 of those girls are still missing today. Well, last week, a similar scene played out in the town of Dapchi, about 170 miles from Chibok. Boko Haram fighters stormed a girls' school there in Dapchi, and 110 girls went missing this time, assumed kidnapped by the militants. Dion Searcy is West Africa bureau chief for the New York Times. She's in Abuja, Nigeria. Dion, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us exactly what happened on Monday. What do we know about how this scene unfolded?
What we know so far is Boko Haram militants from the Islamist sect stormed a school in Dapchi. This is a small town in northern Nigeria. They arrived in town, residents said, specifically looking for the school, stopping to ask people to direct them to the school, in fact, and arrived there, guns blazing, got out of the trucks and started rounding up girls.
What's been the government reaction to this sort of copycat attack? People have been through a version of this before.
People have been through this before, and everyone's surprised, you know, that it could happen again. But also, the government really badly mishandled. I think everyone can agree when the Chibok girls went missing in 2014, there was a lot of silence and misinformation and rumors and only acknowledgement dramatically after the fact a couple weeks later. Here, the time frame is shorter, but similar things have happened. The federal government was silent for at least a day and a half or 2 days initially after this. The governor of the state where Dapchi is located, in fact, told parents the girls had been rescued. All the parents came to the school the next day, you know, hoping to see their daughters, and the governor showed up empty-handed and said, oh, in fact, I've made a mistake. So, you know, your daughters haven't been rescued, and that prompted a minor riot. I mean, people stoned the governor's convoy and were really obviously upset. The military now has publicly blamed the police for not keeping these kids safe. The police blame the military for not telling them they're leaving. And so it's just a big mess.
And so the finger pointing continues, Dion, but Boko Haram was thought to be significantly weakened in Nigeria over the last couple of years. At least that was some of the reporting that we were getting here in the United States. What does this attack show about their strength in Nigeria?
Well, I think when President Buhari came in a few years ago, he really made a concerted effort to revive the military's action. And the military has done a good job taking back control of territory that Boko Haram had seized. But what we've been noticing recently is the military doesn't seem to be that great at holding ground. They'll maybe attack a Boko Haram enclave and then leave, and then Boko Haram comes back. And so I think what we've seen recently is a sort of renewed effort from Boko Haram. I mean, they have been pulling off more complicated attacks on military convoys. They have sent tons of suicide bombers streaming into, you know, marketplaces and mosques. Meanwhile, the president has repeatedly declared that Boko Haram has been defeated. And Nigerians are just, you know, laugh at the absurdity. I mean, obviously they're not defeated, but the government still keeps making that claim.
And do we have any indication of what Boko Haram is trying to accomplish with this latest attack, other than abject terror? Are they hoping to barter for the release of these girls? What do we know?
I mean, that's what a lot of people are suspecting. There were about 100 or so Chibok girls who the government negotiated for their release, and some other high-profile hostages, some police women and university professors recently who were released. And I've been told ransom, you know, in the millions of dollars was paid for all those hostages to be released. And so some people speculate that maybe this was prompting what was happening with Boko Haram in this instance in Dapchi.
Dion Searcy, West Africa bureau chief for the New York Times. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot.
It was Monday morning in November of 2010. Hedge fund manager David Ganek was on his way to work.
It's fair to say this morning was not like any other in my life. On my way to work, right as I was arriving at my office, I happened to see about 20 people from my office standing downstairs where the smokers usually stand, and there aren't 20 smokers in the office. And I got a phone call from the office at about the exact same time saying that the firm had been raided by the FBI.
David Ganek ran a $4 billion hedge fund called Level Global Investors, and it was one of three hedge funds raided that day by the FBI.
The reason they showed up at our doorstep was to, in theory, to preserve evidence. They basically retrieved a bunch of files and more or less got access to our servers And they actually didn't make an arrest for 16 months until after the raid.
The FBI had a search warrant when they arrived at Gannick's business. TV cameras and journalists were waiting there too to report it all, tipped off by the government. But that search warrant was based on a sworn affidavit signed by an FBI agent that said the agency had a credible tip that David Gannett was complicit in insider trading.
From my perspective, the parts of the affidavit that referred to me, and I was the head of the firm, the parts that referred to me were, in fact, lies.
David Gannick's partner was convicted of insider trading, but that conviction was later overturned. Gannick himself was never even charged. He says he knew nothing about the insider trading that brought those federal agents to his doorstep. All the news and the coverage wound up being too much. Gannick's hedge fund closed its doors, and Gannick turned around and sued the federal government. David Gannick acknowledges that a $4 billion hedge fund manager clashing with the feds might not be the most sympathetic character in America today. But Andrew Cohen from the Marshall Project says Gannon's case is an example of the government obtaining a search warrant on false information and no one being held accountable. It's this week's Case in Point.
The reason I took this case is because there's been so much discussion lately in the wake of the Nunes memo, in Washington, the surveillance, the FISA court, the notion of what federal law enforcement officials do and do not put into their affidavits when they're seeking probable cause from a judge to get permission to do surveillance or to get permission to do a search, that it was worth noting that this is something that happens more frequently than the feds are willing to acknowledge. It happens in regular cases. It happens in high-profile cases, and it seems to have happened in this case, where you have an FBI agent swearing an affidavit in which she identifies an informant who makes a direct allegation that David had knowledge of insider trading at his company, which evidently is not true. That affidavit made it into the hands of the judge who issued the warrant that led to the search, that led to the demise of David's business, which happens from time to time. What has struck me since I picked this case is the realization that there appears to have been a wall of silence that's come up since. Was this a misunderstanding between the FBI and U.S. attorneys, or was it something darker?
Andrew, is there more than David's reputation at stake here? Not that that's not important, of course it is, but a judge did rule at one point that the warrant was still good. People in David's firm did get convicted of insider trading. So is it just David's reputation as somebody who knew about this that we should be concerned about?
No, this is not just about one person's right to be free from an unreasonable search. To me, this is about accountability at the federal government. And when you're having this national conversation, right, about federal law enforcement tactics, about what is put into an affidavit, how much context and perspective has to be given to a judge in making a probable cause determination, we need to realize that this does happen more often than we think, and that when it does happen, the feds are very reluctant or simply unwilling to acknowledge the truth of what has happened. And so I went to the Justice Department. The Justice Department isn't saying anything. I reached out to some of the federal officials, the former federal officials who were involved. Silence. The truth is we don't know whether the feds took what happened here seriously enough to undertake their own investigation, and if they did, whether they came to any conclusions.
Right. I mean, isn't the lesson then for police and investigators that you can throw as much at the wall as you want in an affidavit to try to get a warrant? And some of it might be sketchy, most of it might be true, whatever. You get your warrant, you do your investigation, and that's what matters.
Yeah, and I think the lesson of this case is that if you do it, and you get called on it because there are errors, or intentional or not, the courts aren't going to come to your rescue if you're one of those people, a citizen, who gets caught up in all of this. That the message from this case, it seems to me, is that the feds have broad latitude to make the kinds of mistakes that were made here and really don't ever have to answer the ultimate question of whether there was some intentional monkey business going on or whether there was a simple mistake.
Well, David, look, I think it's fair to say, rightly or wrongly, a lot of people across America might not have a ton of sympathy for hedge fund guy who bumped up against some federal investigators. Right. But you are an American who has rights just like everybody else. Why should people care about what happened to Mr. $4 billion when the feds showed up at his doorstep?
Well, look, I'm none of that is lost on me. The caricature that I represent, I completely understand that it is not one that garners sympathy. But I would say two things. One, you do, my rights are every bit as important as everybody else's. And that's frankly the reason I endeavored to do this. It was, when you said it was, it to clear my reputation. I mean, it's very hard to unravel what the government did to my reputation, even though I was never charged. You know, a public raid that is leaked and broadly promoted as a PR event by the government and the press that follows that is just not something that you can undo. And you can only dent whatever that tidal wave of bad publicity was. But given the facts that we had here, we felt that there was a ton of leverage attached to these facts. And if the government could, in fact, do what they did to me and to my firm, Mr. $4 billion hedge fund man, and all the negativity that that represents in this day and age, which I completely understand and can empathize with, you know, the hope here was, and hope is unfortunately all it was or all it ended up being, is that by exposing this behavior and the lack of accountability, which is now, frankly and ironically, much more of a national issue, due to the Nunez memo and all the things that are happening today, there was, I thought, a tremendous amount of leverage attached to this, and that really the people who stood to benefit from this were the people who can actually defend themselves. And unfortunately, you know, when they say you can't fight City Hall, so much of it becomes about protecting your own and about how this whole system works. And it's just, you know, given all that we had going for us, you know, it's just, you know, incredibly frustrating and sad that, you know, you can only make so much of a difference under these circumstances.
David Ganek, former CEO of Level Global. Thanks for being here, David.
Thanks for having me. I appreciated the time.
And Andrew Cohen of the Marshall Project, author of Case in Point. As always, Andrew, thanks.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What happens when a white working class city in Maine gets a culture shock and an influx of thousands of refugees from Somalia? Well, the answer is a lot of tension at times, but the city of Lewiston, Maine had one thing that could bind its people together once they were thrown into the same pot. That was soccer. Amy Bass chronicles the story of the Lewiston High School boys soccer team in her new book. It's called One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought Together a Divided Town. And she tells how that one coach used the game and his team to unite Lewiston.
Lewiston is a factory town. It's filled with red brick factories built along canals that harness the power of the Great Falls of the Androscoggin River. And in its heyday, it was one of the major retail centers of New England. And walking through those streets now, it's a much different place.
And then in 2001, Amy, Lewiston starts to change. Refugees from Somalia begin settling there, sort of the opening chapters of your book. Who are these refugees? Why have they come?
You know, it starts with just a handful of folks. These are folks who lived for years upon years in Kenya in refugee camps. They are relocated to the United States, not to Lewiston directly, to other places. This is what we call a secondary migration. And they look for a place to build a community. And Lewiston has good schools, pretty decent safety record, and a lot of vacant apartments, affordable vacant apartments. So it starts with a handful, and word of mouth spreads, and a handful turns to hundreds, and hundreds turn to thousands.
What was the debate like in the community of Lewiston, the people who were already there when refugees started to arrive?
The debate has had an ebb and a flow. There have been hot, contentious moments in which the town has had to do some reckoning on both sides with itself.
In a recent BBC documentary, Lewiston's mayor, Boston native Bob McDonald, sounded less than welcoming.
You come and you accept our culture, and you leave your culture at the door.
There have been some incidents. There has been, you know, some moments of you know, a mayor writing a letter saying, stop coming. You know, we're tapped enough. And then, you know, ways to find a path forward. And that's really where the story of my book comes in, because the story of One Goal is the story of one of those paths forward.
Talk a little bit more about the Lewiston soccer team and how they were playing, what they were doing as their town started to change.
Yes, soccer was something that Coach would say athletes use to get ready for their real sports, that this is a championship hockey town, that this was a way to stay in shape in the fall. And as Somalis brought a passion for soccer to Lewiston, it wasn't that it became a soccer town instead of a hockey town. It became a hockey town and a soccer town. They began to fill the parks. You began to see, you know, refugee youth leagues. And they found their way onto the high school team.
So talk about Coach Mike McGraw, because he's a central character here.
He is a central character. My favorite thing that the players say about Mike McGraw is that Coach doesn't care where we're from as long as we pass the ball. And I think that that speaks volumes, right, to how he approached this. He calls it the advantage of the ball, that the rules of soccer, the way that you build a play, the way that you build a team, was a natural way for this team to serve as an exemplar for the community.
But let's not be too Pollyannish about it. He starts to notice that he doesn't have a well-oiled integrated unit of American kids, Somali kids, playing together on one team. It's not quite like that at first.
No, there's a real turning point for this team. It happens in August, preseason practice, and he's walking to the practice field. And this story is almost legend within the team now. He notices that they're getting ready separately. They're putting their socks and shin guards and cleats on separately. And he thinks to himself, I'm a coach. I know how to do this. This is what I do. And he just started shouting names and pointing and physically moving them. And then talk to them about what it means to be a team, that it means high fives in the hallway, and it means going to a football game together, and it means going to the movies together, and it means getting ready, sitting next to one another. And it was a real turning point. It was a turning point that all of the players felt, and it was a turning point that Mike McGraw really felt they were waiting for.
So Lewiston starts to change in 2001. By 2007, 2008, the team is taking on more Somali kids who've come to town. And then you jump forward to the 2015 season. What happens?
The 2015 season they're a nationally ranked team for the first time. They outscore their opponents going into the postseason by 100 goals. They are undefeated. They are determined. So that 2015 season, their one goal largely is to win, make history for the school, but also bring Mike McGraw his first state championship.
Listen up. All right, we're doing this for the guy on the left and for the guy on the right. All right, we're doing this for the community. We're doing this for Coach McGraw, all right? They'd give up anything to be on this field right now, all right? Last year we were here, we lost it. This is our year. No one's going to stop us, right?
Yeah! Yeah!
The stands full with Lewiston Blue, Scarborough Red on both sides, about 4,500 in attendance. First half, Blue Devils controlling play. Omar Abdi Sharif and his team into the second half. Lewiston's Malid Abdal with a dangerous flip throw-in. Here, it deflects off a Scarborough defender in the box. And it's a goal, and Lewiston takes a 1-0 lead. The Blue Devils hang on for the 1-0 victory. The first championship for the Blue Devils in high school soccer, and the first for Mike McGraw, the head coach, in his 33rd year as the coach.
We just didn't give up, and he taught us to work hard all 90 minutes.
2015 State of Maine Boys Classic.
A huge victory for Mike McGraw, a huge victory for the team, of course, but talk about how the city of Lewiston experienced that win.
You know, that day in November in 2015 at Portland's Fitzpatrick Stadium, they had to keep opening up new sections of bleachers. There were 4,500 soccer fans in those stands. So you're looking beyond the parents of just the teams, right? You're looking at the entire community being there. And everyone that you talk to was about, we have to all be there. This is a we moment. And they were. They were there by the thousands. They celebrated that game as a community. They celebrated it for weeks afterwards as a community. It was a coming together.
And you issue a cautionary tale as well. Immigration, assimilation, culture is a little more complicated than a good soccer season.
It is. Coming together isn't staying together. And when you look at the 2016 election, Androscoggin County went Republican for the first time in a long time. So these moments offer these snapshots, but we need to keep building on them.
The book is One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and A Game That Brought Together a Divided Town, the story of soccer in Lewiston, Maine. Amy Bass is the author. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to the Portland Press, Herald, and WMTW-TV for the audio that you heard from Lewiston's 2015 championship victory. Amy Bass's book, One Goal, is out today. Have you ever experienced the unifying power of sports?
This is Angela from Swarthmore, Illinois. Nothing brought Chicago together more than when the Cubs won the World Series after the 100-year-plus drought. People of all races, nationalities, and faiths were hugging each other without regard.
This is Kelly from Wayzata. On a very local level, one of my daughters played high school soccer. The team she played with graduated in 2011, but the bond that the girls and the parents created is still as tight as when they were playing. There's a true caring that developed. When on the field, each child became all of our children. It became a family unit.
That's great, Angela. Look, can't we all get along without the Cubs having to win to do it? Huh? Just kidding, Chicago. You get the victory. We love you. Tomorrow here on The Takeaway, we're talking about the NRA and how that organization has evolved and changed its tactics over the last 30 years from an enthusiast group to a conservative culture warrior. And we want to hear from you. Are you an NRA member? Tell us when you joined the organization and what the group means to you. Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.